It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan, Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66, WFAN and WFAN-FM, New York.
Wow, good morning, and welcome to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori on this Sunday morning, July 25th. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me for this hour, and hope you're enjoying a great season of golf. Talking Golf with Ann Liguori is brought to you by IB Cool Luxury Athleisure Apparel for men and women, featuring the exclusive ice fill cooling technology, along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Visit ibkul.com to learn more. And wow, just some breaking news. And before I went to bed last evening, I read a PGA Tour news bulletin announcing that Bryson DeChambeau will not be competing at the Olympics after testing positive for COVID-19. That's crazy. Patrick Reed will take his place in Tokyo. Bryson DeChambeau apparently tested positive for COVID-19 as part of the final testing protocol before he was supposed to leave the U.S. for Tokyo. And Patrick Reed is undergoing the required testing protocol today and tomorrow before he is supposed to depart for Japan. The first round of the golf competition is Thursday, this coming Thursday. So it's right upon us, everybody. Reed is now the only two-time Olympian for the men's competition for Team USA. He played in 2016. And now it will be Patrick Reed on the American team, along with Justin Thomas, Colin Morikawa, and Xander Schauffele in the men's competition. The women will play August 4th through the 7th, and the American team features Kelly Norda, Lexi Thompson, Daniel Kang, and Jessica Korda. And then this morning, I get a statement from the International Golf Federation that informed everyone that John Rahm tested positive for COVID-19 as part of the final testing protocol before leaving for the Olympic Games. And so John Rahm is unable to compete for Spain. The Spanish Olympic Committee stated that without adequate time to find a replacement and comply with the necessary health protocols required for the Olympics, Spain will only be represented by one player, Adri Amas. So this is weird, man. Something is really fishy here. John Rahm, this was the third test taken for John Rahm before traveling. They have all kinds of protocols for these Olympics, as you know. So John Rahm, he tests positive again less than 2 months after testing positive for COVID while playing in the Memorial Tournament, where he had that six-shot lead after the third round when he found out he had tested positive and had to withdraw from the tournament. Then he got vaccinated, he told us, and returned after negative test results to compete in the U.S. Open, which he went on to win. And so now he tests positive again. Just really strange stuff. So both John Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau are out of the Olympics. Just pretty shocking news, in my opinion. But it does show that the virus is still very prevalent around us, and we have to continue to be very diligent, even if we're vaccinated. Now, I don't know if Bryson DeChambeau is vaccinated or not, but I do remember John Rahm telling us that he regretted not getting through the vaccination process earlier when he tested positive at the Memorial. And then afterwards, right before the U.S. Open started at the press conference during the whole week at Torrey Pines, John Rahm said that he had been vaccinated. So that's crazy news. But anyway, neither will be able to compete for their prospective teams at the Olympics. And speaking of golf in the Olympics, I mean, don't you think they should play more of a team competition instead of stroke play? I'd rather see the Olympic golf competition be more like a Ryder Cup or a Solheim Cup format, you know, with match play, which I think is more team-oriented and more fun to watch. I'm not sure if stroke play is really the format that they should be doing in the Olympics, but that's been the format. It was the format in 2016 when golf re-entered the Olympic arena. And that was just the second time that golf has been in the Olympics since 1904, this time around. This is the second time that, you know, golf has really been in the Olympics since 1904. So I am just back from 5 days in northern Idaho on a wonderful golf trip. It was a quick, short and sweet, but, you know, a lot of times golfers will ask me, where should I go and play? What courses do you recommend? What areas do you recommend? And I can tell you to put Coeur d'Alene Golf Course and Circling Raven on your list. I just thought they were both exceptional experiences. Coeur d'Alene is situated on a gorgeous lake and features the only floating green on the planet, the par 3 14th. You might have seen it, you might have heard of it, but you take a boat from the tee area to the green, which floats on Lake Coeur d'Alene. It's absolutely stunning. And the green is on a pulley and can be, you know, moved to change the distances. I don't think they change the distance too often, but it's quite the golf hole, and it has to be one of the most photographed holes in the world for its beauty and obviously for its uniqueness. So on the boat ride back, the captain of the boat gives you a certificate if your tee shot lands on the green. I'm happy to say mine did, and I made the par on the hole. And it's just such a fun experience. And challenging too, but the course was designed by Steve Miller, inspired by the owner of the resort, the late Dwayne Hagedin. And there are a lot of great holes on that golf course. It's not just a floating green, but that gets most of the attention. But there are back-to-back par threes on the front that are just stunning, the par fives, some long par fours. And basically, to get there, you just fly into Spokane, Washington, and then it's a 45-minute drive over the border to get to Idaho. I loved my caddy, Shane, and the overall service was impeccable. So then we also played a course called Circling Raven, staying at the Coeur d'Alene Casino and Resort. And Circling Raven is stunning. It's built on the Indian reservation out there, over 600 acres of land, and no houses on the golf course. All you see are mountains, the prairies, the meadows, the valleys, and land so diverse. I mean, you feel like you're in an episode of Yellowstone, which I know is supposed to be Montana, which is Montana, but we're in Idaho here. The views look pretty similar. Just spectacular. And that course was designed by Gene Bates. And they will be hosting a Symetra Tour event in August. So that will be cool. And, you know, much to my surprise, as I'm walking into the clubhouse at Circling Raven, I hear this guy say, Ann. And it was a guy named Jared Carter who lives in that area, but he was my caddy at the Bob Hope Classic in California back in 2011. I couldn't believe it. There he was in the pro shop. So golf is such an amazing sport. You know, it's like family. It was just so amazing to reconnect with Jared, who was my caddy at the Bob Hope years ago in La Quinta, California. And he just made my experience there just so wonderful. It was a great experience for sure. Not too many women, you know, get asked to play in that tournament. And, I was one of the few that year, and it was just pretty memorable, to say the least. I'll have to tell you about it someday. Good and bad, but anyway. All right, the U.S. Senior Women's Open is taking place this week at Brooklawn Country Club in Fairfield, Connecticut, and the one and only Jan Stevenson, who helped put the LPGA on the map in the 70s and early 80s, she is playing in the championship. along with defending champion Helen Alfredson, Annika Sorenstam, Laura Davies, Julie Inkster, to name a few, and Jan Stevenson will be joining us in a few minutes to spend some time with us here on Talking Golf. She's from Australia, as you know. She joined the LPGA in 1974, was named Rookie of the Year that year, and in the early 80s, she won 3 major championships, including the 82 LPGA championships, the 83 U.S. Women's Open. She's won 16 LPGA tour events, 41 worldwide victories, 10 Legends tournaments. I mean, her resume is unbelievable. She was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2019. And many of you may remember that Jan Stevenson was one of the first LPGA stars to openly embrace a sex sells approach to marketing. Remember she posed in the bathtub that was filled with golf balls? And it was on the cover of Sports Illustrated back in 1977. She did a pinup calendar. So she's had a most fascinating career. And in addition to playing in the Legends and the Senior Championships coming up this week, she is in the wine and spirits business. And so we'll talk to her about that. And she also is in the world of golf course design with Cynthia Dye McGreary. So we'll talk to her about her design business as well. Let's see what else is going on. Well, sad news in the Met Golf section as former Fordham golf coach Paul Dillon, father of actors Matt and Kevin Dillon, he passed away this past week at the age of 86. He coached the Fordham University men's golf team for 22 years. He was voted the Atlantic 10 Coach of the Year back in 2004. He was also a very talented artist, and he painted the portraits of many of the Gold Tee Award winners at our dinner at the Met Golf Writers Association. For years, he won the Distinguished Service Award back in 2003, and he's a past president of the Metropolitan Golf Association. And he just was such a lovely person and always made it a point to talk with me during the receptions at these Met Golf Writer National Awards dinners, and just such a kind guy, so personable. So I'm sending out condolences to his family and the entire golf community who mourns his passing. He will definitely be missed. Just an amazing guy. The women are playing a major championship this weekend, the Amundi Evian Championship in Evian, France, one of the 5 majors on the women's golf calendar. And a day after Joan Lee 6 tied the lowest round in major championship history with a 10-under-61, she shot a 3-under-68 yesterday, leads the championship by 5 strokes. She is 18-under for the championship overall. Unbelievable. The 72-hole record for an LPGA major is 21-under. So Lee 6 is on her way, perhaps, for more record breaking performances. If she can keep up her stellar play, it would be her 2nd major title. She won the 2019 U.S. Women's Open at the Country Club of Charleston. The PGA Tour is playing the 3M Open in Blaine, Minnesota. Cameron Tringali at 12-under has a 1-shot lead over Gary Woodland and Maverick McNealy. 8 players are 2 behind at 10-under. Tringali posted a bogey-free 5-under-66. And is looking for his first career PGA Tour title in his 307th start. All right, that is what is going on. We are going to take a quick break. Coming up, Hall of Fame golfer Jan Stevenson. She'll be playing in the U.S. Senior Women's Open this coming week at Brookalawn Country Club in Fairfield, Connecticut. We'll talk golf, wine, golf course design, in addition to a lot more. But first, let me tell you that Ivy Cool is a luxury athleisure wear for both men and women, offering the highest performance-driven apparel to look and feel your best on and off the course. Ivy Cool offers multifunctional intelligent, the exclusive moisture sensor fabric featuring ice fill technology that cools your body so you can stay comfortable and odor-free on hot and humid days. Ivy Cool apparel also features UPF 50+ sun protection, colorful, stylish, ultra-soft fabric with the latest technology to protect your skin. Look and feel your best. Learn more at ibcool.com. That's ibkul.com.
It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan.
Welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori on this Sunday morning. Glad you're joining us for our weekly discussion of golf news and the personalities who light up the game. And one of those stars is none other than the great Jan Stevenson, LPGA star, wine connoisseur, golf course designer, and playing in this week's U.S. Senior Women's Championship at Brooklawn Country Club in Fairfield, Connecticut. Good morning, Jan. Welcome to Talking Golf.
Thank you, Anne. It's nice to be with you.
Nice to connect with you. Where does one start with Jan Stevenson, who you've had such a legendary career on and off the course? And I guess let's start with your playing career. You won Rookie of the Year honors the first year on the LPGA Tour back in 1974. You won 9 major titles overall, 16 LPGA titles, 41 worldwide victories, 10 titles on the Legends Tour. How is your game right now, Jan, as you get ready to compete this
week?
Well,
it's never as good as you want it to be. And that, I played a practice round there last 2 days, and now I'm back in, I'm in Washington, D.C. But the golf course is beautiful. Obviously, it's in great condition. And, you know, Brooklawn is we played there in 1978, but I don't remember much about the course. The only thing I remember when I drove up the other day was there was one little sign that said, welcome to, well, it was said Brooklawn Country Club. And in those days, before we played it, I think it was 78 or 79, you know, we didn't have GPS. We were sent like this one little tiny map from, you know, that they'd gotten out of on a page, and it was taken out of, you know, like a map book. And it was trying to find this place. And that was the first thing I remember when I drove up. Like, I remember that sign thinking, finally, I found the place. And now it's so easy, obviously, with GPS, that it was pretty funny.
And the sign is still there.
Exact same sign. Yeah. It says since 1929 or something. Yeah.
Well, I know it's a Tillinghast design. He redid it back in the 20s. And I've never played it, but I can't wait to go up there this week and watch you women compete. And how does your game compare now to when you start on the LPGA Tour, do you think?
Well, unfortunately, I hit it a lot shorter. You know, when I was mugged in 1991, it took, you know, they broke my left hand in so many places and my fingers. And so I only hold on with my forefinger and my thumb. So I've lost probably 30 yards, and it makes it hard to play. I mean, I know I've developed a great short game because of it, but there's nothing that can take away from having power.
Right, right. Yeah, I remember when that happened. That was back when? When did that happen?
In the 90s, early 90s, yeah.
Gosh. In Miami, wasn't it?
It was in Miami. I was going to watch a basketball game, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so you're not really holding the club with, you know, a full strength, obviously. And so do you think, though, that power is the first to go? I mean, can you make up for power with finesse and shot making?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, I think golf has really become so much more of a power game. I mean, you know, you watch the LPGA and the PGA, they've all hit it so much further. And so the golf courses are designed that way. But, you know, U.S. Opens are probably the only ones, believe it or not, where people think, oh, power is a big advantage. But the hitting fairways and greens is a huge advantage in majors because, you know, especially the U.S. Open, I know the USGA's goal is for the winning score to be even par. And so what happens is that if you try to be aggressive, you know, they really punish you. And especially this golf course, it's very hilly. The greens slope from back to front. And so if you, you know, you have to, if you hit it like pin high to the left or the right of the green in the bunkers, it's really hard to get up and down because you've got to judge how much it's going to break off the slope. So it's definitely a defensive golf course, which is probably good for me because I don't hit it as high and as far as I used to, but I certainly hit it very straight. So I have probably more advantage in a U.S. Open than I would in a normal tournament.
That's interesting. So how much time can you really commit to practicing and training and playing? We're going to get into all the other stuff you're doing in a little bit, but how much time can you really practice?
Well, I have, over the last 5 years, I have not practiced very much at all. You know, I probably play in the men's game once a week and something like that, but really not much at all. And so I've actually committed after working this hard to try to get back to some kind of normalcy, but I'm not going to let my game get that far behind. Because, you know, during COVID, I was like, oh, well, we've got it. Everything was canceled, all of our Legends events. So I'm like, oh, I'm just going to really knuckle down and do all my, you know, real job work. And then it's taken me so long and so many hours to just get back to where I feel comfortable on the golf course. So I'm not going to let that happen again, because people expect you. You know, I started to think, well, maybe I'll just get a handicap. And that way, when I show up, people go, well, you know, you're even and you're playing from the men's tees. And I'm like, no, I need a handicap if I'm going to play back here. And then they look at you strangely. So I was like, well, maybe I'll get a handicap. But I think the thing is just to keep practicing a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel that kind of pressure because of your success when you played on the LPGA Tour? I would assume that any time you tee it up now, everybody's going to expect you to be, you know, just unbelievable, right?
Yeah, I know. I played in one event and they said, so are you a plus one or plus two? And I'm like, no, for the men's teams, I probably shoot, you know, in the high 70s and play really well, because there's some par fours I won't be able to reach. And they're like, really? And they won't do it. They just go, no, you can't be. So it's so hard to explain. Look, hey, that was a long time ago, and I don't practice and play. Now, some players, you know, like a Hollis Stacey, somebody that really just plays and practices every day and works out, you know, it's probably okay for them to be in, you know, a scratch handicap. But I've actually gone into so many other things that golf, and it's hard to compete to remember what it was like. And then when you go out there and you're like, I know I can hit that shot, and then you don't, you're like so upset.
Yeah, I would imagine, you know, it must be frustrating because you're used to making those kinds of shots. But
yeah.
Are the players competing this week, Jen, who do you think may be playing closest to the way they played when they competed on the LPGA Tour?
Well, I think that's a pretty obvious answer is going to be Annika. She's been playing a lot on the European Tour. And she just, you know, she came off her top five finish at the celebrity event where she played. And so she's, and, you know, she focused on this. I know there's about four or five players when they announced we were going to have a women's senior open, and that's all they've worked on. And, you know, Michelle McGann and of course you've got Julie and Laura Davies and Helen Alfredson that still compete quite a bit on the LPGA. So when you play a lot, when you play in tournaments, you find a way to get it out there no matter what, you know, you have to. And so those girls just bomb it just like they do on the regular LPGA tour. So it's a huge advantage to be competitive. I know when I talked to Pat Bradley last year and she said, you know, I'm not going to play anymore on, you know, in the Open. I'm like, how could you not, just because it's a women's senior? She said, well, number one, it should have been 20 years ago. And number two, it's just such a hard, how do you stand up there on the first tee and be that nervous and not tournament ready when all these the players that are going to win and compete are used to those butterflies? It's just a little bit of butterflies instead of something that's like terrifying.
Right. I remember a couple years ago, I get an invitation to play in the member guest at Lake Nona in Orlando every year. A good friend of mine is a member there. And Annika played in it a couple years ago. And she had said, oh, Ann, I don't play that much golf anymore. But I guess now she, you know, as you say, focusing on the U.S. Senior Women's Open, Annika, she was training. I didn't realize she was playing some tournaments in Europe as well. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, she's really tournament ready. I think this is something that's very important to it, and we're another USGA event, and and the trophy is gorgeous. I have to admit, the one thing is that, you know, you see the trophy and I just get jealous because they have pictures up of, you know, of Laura and Helen, the first two winners, and I'm like, oh my, and I was there when they announced it. They were showing the trophy and announcing the Open, and it's such a beautiful trophy. I'm like, damn, I wish I had one of those.
Well, you admit, the U.S. Senior Women's Open has only been around since 2015. And, you know, there seem to be so many more tournaments and opportunities for women to play, you know, who are over 50, you know, well until into their later years than there were, say, what, a decade ago. So is this too, maybe too much too late? Or what are your thoughts about all these events now and opportunities now, but not years ago?
Well, and that's been, you know, a very sore point with quite a few of us. I mean, we've been campaigning with the USGA for 20 years on this. And, you know, and they kept, you know, and it was very insulting when they'd say, well, we don't know if you'll play well enough. And, you know, and I'm talking big names, Patty Sheehan, Beth Daniel, Meg Mallon, you know, Nancy Lopez. I mean, Amy Alcott, all the, you know, Pat Brown, all the big Hall of Famers. And we were campaigning in a long time, and actually Mike Wan was one that did help us, because I remember going in 2013 to Pinehurst and meeting with Mike Davis in the USGA, going, you know, and my point was we all had to make some point that was important, and then she brought all the past Open champions, and my point was I won the U.S. Open in 1983, and that was the year Billy Casper won the first men's senior Open. And here we are still pushing in the 2013 trying to get a women's senior Open. And then what Mike Wan said, well, legally, you have an ad in a campaign that says that we have a championship for every golfer. And you don't. So you've either got to stop that campaign, or we're going to campaign that you're not taking care of women, females, the women. And they were, that's what terrified them, I think. And it's a good point.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Now, obviously, Michael Wan is now with the USGA, but under his leadership as the commissioner of the LPGA, the last 10, 11 years, the LPGA really became a global tour, and the prize money and the number of tournaments just expanded tremendously. What were your thoughts about that? I'm sure you were pleased to see how much it had grown, at least in the last, decade or so.
Exactly. I mean, because I know it struggled, the LPGA struggled for a long time. And a lot of that was because we had so many big names that were similar age when we kind of couldn't play anymore. It, you know, there wasn't any real people that would stand out, you know, players that people could, you know their personalities, you know, because we had so many crazy, you know, great personalities. And of course, Lopez stood out as the number one. And so it didn't have an identity. And I know that, you know, Charlie Meacham and then Ty really struggled. And then we struggled getting a really good commissioner. So Mike Wan did an amazing job turning the tour around and taking advantage of saying, hey, wait a minute, there's so many international players. Why don't we take advantage and go to their sponsors and their countries and get it going? And it was a brilliant idea. And he's done an amazing job.
Amazing job. We're talking to Hall of Famer Jan Stevenson. And Jan, you weren't shy back in the day about using sex appeal to market yourself and the LPGA. Could you talk about those times? What was it like? And were those marketing decisions basically your own, or did other people bring you some of these ideas? You know, when you posed on the cover of Sports Illustrated in a bathtub with all the golf balls everybody remembers that cover photo, right? What were those times like for you?
Well, it was pretty exciting. You know, I used to think every time I'd complain about it and saying it's hurting my game, I'm tired, it's a lot of, you know, exposure when I really would like to just work on my game. And the commissioner's like, no, this is helping the tour. But it wasn't my decision. I was just really kind of, I came over from Australia and was ready to just, you know, knuckle down and play and reach my goals. And the new commissioner in 1970, five came along and said, hey, he was from the NHL, and he said, we've got to market how many fantastic players are out here and personalities. And he wanted some new image. And of course, I was from Australia. Nobody knew about me. So he said, I'd like you to be the kind of the face of the LPGA for us to get going. So of course, he used it very well. I mean, they moved the LPGA from Atlanta to New York and hired a big advertising agency and marketing company and said, let's do it. And I remember, you know, having to travel and meet potential sponsors and play golf with them. And the commissioner and I would, you know, we'd spend quite a bit of time. And of course, the publicity was a lot of it was interesting watching what they would do. You know, every town we'd go in, they'd go, okay, you're going to be seen with this football player or this baseball player. And then they'd let everybody know at AP. And I thought we'd be just going for a dinner or something. And next thing, there was pictures being taken. And it's like, oh, my God. And it was big news the next day that, you know, I was dating somebody. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I used to, it's actually laugh. My mom, my parents would come over in the summer and my dad would caddy. And my mother would say, are you going to be on National Choir every week, every town we go in? Like, I just wish we'd have kept some of that stuff because I used to read there and go, golfer seen with Ed Marinaro at New York Nets, New York Jets. And I'd be like, oh, what golf is that? And like, oh, my God, that's me. And
oh,
it
that's
was like,
funny.
It was crazy. And it was fun, obviously. It was a lot of attention. And some of the players didn't like it at first. But when he would get up at our meetings and say, look, this is bringing in extra 10,000 people a week when she goes to play, when she plays. And when she doesn't play, you know, it's down. The media is down. So it was really interesting to watch how they did it. And, of course, you know, as the years went on, I mean, my sponsors would take advantage of it and say, hey, can we do a calendar to try to sell some golf balls? And so it became this image that really wasn't me, but it was kind of fun to write. And people talk about wonder what it'd be like now with all the social media. I wouldn't be able to move with all the, you know, it'd be crazy, the things that would be happening, but it was definitely a fun time.
Wow. Well, how much criticism did you have to deal with when that, you know, magazine cover came out with you in the bathtub with all the golf balls? Was there any criticism? Was there a downside to it for you?
There was a downside. I mean, it's kind of interesting how now with the Legends Tour, I'm really friends with so many of the ones that even criticized me. And now I'm very close friends with Jane Blaylock and a lot of the players, Kathy Whitworth and, you know, the players that thought that it was really hurting the woman's image and, you know, women athletes and what they were trying to do because it was all about, you know, sex appeal and they said it's really taking away from the game and I could always tell if they were talking about me if I'd walk in the locker room and there'd be, you know, all this noise and there'd be dead silence and I'd be like, uh-oh, they're talking about me. And so I really didn't have a great relationship with a lot of players out there. And the commission would try to say, stop criticizing this. Look what's happening to the tour. We're getting all these extra sponsors, you know, long time. We're getting 10-year contracts with them and television and all this media exposure. I mean, look at the papers every week. And they go, yeah, but it's always about Jan. It's like what she's wearing and who she's seeing. And it's like, who cares? It's about us. And that's what it takes. I mean, to get sponsors, it's got to be media exposure. And so it was very educational, but it was hard for me to be in the middle of it for a long time. And it was actually funny when we first started the Legends Tour, because sometimes I would just come in just like, you know, to the pro-am parties and nothing special. And they'd be like, can't you wear a low-cut dress or something next time? And I'd be like, man, things have turned around a lot.
Oh, my God. Just fascinating, Jan Stevenson. Unbelievable. We're going to continue talking to Jan. You have so much going on. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue this discussion on, you know, marketing and golf, wine, course design. So stay where you are. We'll be back with Hall of Famer Jan Stevenson in a second. But first, let me tell you, as the brand ambassador for IB Cool, I can attest to the high-quality, performance-driven leisure apparel line that is perfect to wear on and off the course. Not only does the moisture sensor fabric keep me cool on the links, IB Cool garments also feature UPF 50 plus sun protection. All this plus a wide variety of colorful and stylish silhouettes in tops, shorts, pants, skorts, and dresses. And men can choose from many styles as well. Look your best, protect your skin. IB Cool. Learn more at ibkul.com.
It's Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori on The Fan.
Welcome back to Talkin' Golf with Ann Liguori. So happy you can join us. And I'm delighted that Hall of Famer Jan Stevenson continues here on Talkin' Golf. Just incredible career. And not only is she just a star in golf on the course, but She also owns her own wine label, and she's a golf course designer, and we're going to get into all that. And she's playing in this week's U.S. Senior Women's Open, which will take place at Brooklawn Country Club in Fairfield, Connecticut. And Jan, thanks so much for continuing to talk with us. I just think you're just such a fascinating individual, and I really feel that, you know, you did so much to put women's golf on the map back in the 70s and early 80s. And I mean, do you feel as if women's golf really was more popular because of you and say Nancy Lopez when you guys played?
Well, we certainly had huge galleries. I mean, there's no question that the galleries, I think because there's so much competition to watch on, it's so much easier for people just to watch on TV. You know, you've got golf channels so they can turn it on, and there's so much other sports and things going on for people's attention. I mean, the galleries have started to get a little bigger, but we had enormous galleries all the time. I mean, you know, even in practice rounds, it was just, I know our commissioner used to try to put Nancy and I at different times. Like if we had, you know, an early late shift, I'd be one and she'd be the other, because he wanted to keep people there and spread out the gallery. But it was, I remember, you know, winning the major, my LPGA championship at Kings Island, and the galleries were enormous. I mean, they lined the fairways and the chairs, and it was just a totally different time. I mean, it's the LPGA, even though we're, you know, they have great players and we've got a lot of tournaments, they don't have the galleries we had back then. I don't know. I think it's probably, like you said, the personalities. You know, I mentioned earlier, with just so many people that there was someone there that someone could identify with. And there was probably only about 20 girl players that were like really could win any time. And they were fantastic players. And to be part of that was really amazing. So that all of them had their own gallery. And, you know, just this week when they're asking how many tickets you needed for just people I'd met over the years, and I was like, well, I probably need at least, you know, 50 people that I know are coming. And they're like, oh, we don't even, they're not even like roping off the golf course. So they were shocked the first year we had the one in Chicago. They didn't even put any bleachers and have any, excuse me, concession stands up. And people were like lining up, coming in the practice rounds and like, oh, we didn't expect galleries. And it was really quite surprising.
But could you imagine if the commissioner would go up to a player in these times and say, hey, I think you should pose in a bathtub with golf balls? I mean, that is, you know, it just seems so, you know, politically incorrect these days, right? I don't think that
I
could ever happen.
know. Well, I think it would have to be up to them, but certainly not. I know when, you know, when he said, look, this is going to, you know, that'll make you a Hall of Fame player, because I kept saying, it's taking away from my game. I'm really, really exhausted doing these every Monday to help. And he's like, yes, but if not, the tour was going, you know, down the tubes. And number two is that, you know, you're getting so much attention, and, you know, and people kept saying, well, why are you running from doing a press day to then going and doing a corporate outing? But, you know, I was getting paid a lot of money. It was like second place prize money to go play, to do a corporate outing in those days, just to have me there. And, you know, if you said to somebody, they're going to pay you second place prize money, well, of course you would. Now the prize money is so much more. It would be, you know, it'd be crazy. But people go, well, why are you wearing yourself out? And you go, well, it's pretty obvious, you know, you know, you're a superstar, you want to take advantage of that. And it, but if I know that, just actually when I first retired from the LPGA tour and they go, hey, we're going back to that golf course that you won a tournament at, and they want the LPGA want you to come do the press conference, I'm like, oh, okay. And they'd say, and we're going to pay you. I'm like, what? Because in those days, of course, we didn't have the money, and you'd never get paid to do something. So it, nowadays, if you had a top player say, hey, we want you to do something for the LPGA, they would expect to get paid.
Absolutely. I mean, times have changed so much just since, what, the 90s, really. Well, let's shift gears here, and let's talk about your Hall of Fame induction back in 2019. What was that like, and was that one of the greatest highlights of your career?
Without question. It was the most regret I had playing that I was not going to get in the Hall of Fame, because I, you know, because nowadays very, very few people, the players that I played against, knew how hard I worked to help the tour, that the young players had no idea, and the people, the influential people that would get you in the Hall of Fame had no idea, because they're all, you know, more modern day. But when they opened it up to the international wins, because I was kind of the first of my kind that really did travel the world and play a lot of the other tours, and the fact that I came from Australia, and so I was always not known as an international player, but there was no category. Like now we have categories for international players, and, you know, and as well as the US, or if you're resident of US, and both. Well, I was like there was only two of us. It was Sally Little and myself, and then Chuck Owen and Ayaka came on, but we were the only two, and so there was no category for us. So when I would travel to Japan or Europe or go back and play in the Australian Open, they didn't have any category. But when they opened that up because they wanted Retief in and a lot of the international men, I came in on my qualifications. So that was, but you still have to be voted in by all the Hall of Famers. And so technically, because there's 150 or 60 Hall of Famers still alive, 100 of them are men, so they always vote for all the men to get in and none of the women. So it was always going to be, well, is this ever going to happen? And Nancy Lopez is on the final board. So it's Nancy Lopez and Annika, who took Arnold's place when he passed away, and then Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus. So those four are the final ones that, after it's all picked and it's down to the top 10, then they separate it from there. And so Nancy said to me she was always having the one, because I'd always get to the top 10 and never get any further. And she would, and then that final board has to call and say you didn't make it. So it was one of those things that every year she'd call, or every second year, because the Hall of Fame's every 2 years, she'd call and say, you didn't get in this time. But she's like, I promise, your record cannot be overcome, overlooked over and over and over. And I was so upset that I'm thinking, you know, if I hadn't have done all that work for the tour, would the tour have gone away? And I know I would have won more. And I was like, wow, who would have thought, you know? And you look back at it. And then when she called she called me when I knew it was into the last 10. And then I saw her name come up on my phone, and I went, hey, poor Nancy, she always has to do this. And every year she's done it to call me, she's always crying and feels really bad, because, and it's, you know, and she's very emotional. And when she called, she was crying, and I went, Nancy, I'm so sorry you're having to be the one to do this. And she said, what? And she said, I want, stop. I'm calling, telling you you're in. And I was crying, saying, don't worry about it. I was crying. And I could hear Jack and Gary laughing in the background, and because they were doing it on speaker. And I went, what did you say? And Gary said, listen to what she has to say. And I went, Nancy said, no, you're in. And I was bawling by then. So it was really important.
What a great story. I'd never heard that story.
Yeah.
That is so
yeah.
great. You're making me cry.
Oh, I know. I'm getting emotional and got goosebumps all over again.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so happy for you, really.
Thank you. Okay, we
have to get to your wine business, and because I know you're also in the course design business as well. But first, the wine. When did you get into the wine business? And just tell us about it. How'd you start?
Well, I always just had a label in Australia, and I had a really good winemaker there. And he was pretty famous. He's, you know, always winemaker of the year, and he was near where my hometown was. And so, I would just really basically put my label on it. And then, I got engaged, and my fiance was the president of, Fry's Foods, which is owned by Kroger. And he's like, let's do your own over here, because he was really into wine. And so I had to buy the winery, because, you know, it would have been a conflict for him, but he was like, oh, I get in all the stores and we can retire. So then my winemaker said, well, you need to go to sommelier school. So I went back to Australia and went to sommelier and got my sommelier and license. And then he came to Australia, to America, and in Paso Robles, and he was making for my next door neighbor, who has a huge winery, in mine. And then, unfortunately, my fiance was coming to watch me play a tournament, and he got a blood clot and went to his lung, and he died. So I was left with this winery not knowing how to do any of the business part of it. And so I had to then learn very quickly, you know, in 2011, how now to get my wine in everywhere. So I started traveling all over, trying to get distributors and meeting with companies and hoping that, you know, the grocery stores would take it. And you know, it was really hard work because it's a very difficult and competitive business. And I felt like I had a good product. And then in 2016, I was just like, I'm so tired of traveling and doing this, and barely it's a wash, you know, it's not really working. And then 2 years ago, we decided, my management company just said, why don't we just buy a distributorship and let's just focus on one state. You live in Florida. Let's just focus on Florida, and you make only enough wine in your winery for that anyway, instead of trying to piecemeal it and throw against the wall and try to get places spread out. So we did that. It started winning all kinds of awards, and now it's taken off. And so now I have states calling me. And so I do a lot of wine tastings now at country clubs and talk of the stories about the tour. And so and there's so many wine clubs at the country clubs, and it's nice just to be able to drive to all of these formats rather than flying all over the country. So I finally figured out the formula. And then after it started doing well, I bought part of a distillery. And so now I have, you know, spirits, which my pineapple flavored rum wins everywhere we go because of the water coming in from the distilleries in Salt Lake City, where they were down in the aquifer and the water's so good. And I used real fruit. If we're going to have pure water, we can't use artificial flavors. So I have a mango, a pineapple, and a passion fruit, and they just win every award we put them in.
That's awesome. So you're doing flavored rum as well.
I am. Well, I do vodka and gin, and my vodka won top 50 in the world from the Taste Institute. And it's cheaper than Tito's, and it really is handcrafted. So it's true. It's actually really good. And so I don't drink much liquor. I do drink wine. And so it was an introduction that has really turned out to be great.
Well, I know Michael Bolton has raved about the Reserve Cabernet.
He has. He does. Every time he comes to town, I usually send some over to him. He does quite a tour around Florida. He always likes it when he finally gets done. And in fact, last time I came, I brought rum. I brought the pineapple rum. He goes, "Where's the wine?" I'm like, "Well, I need you to promote my rum." And he's like, "I hope you brought wine for later." I'm like, "Yes, I did."
Oh my gosh! Well, we have 1 minute left. So, and I know you're collaborating in the golf course design business with none other than a member of the Dye family, Cynthia Dye McGarry, right?
Yes, and Cynthia worked on quite a few courses in the early 2000s. I really thought this was going to be something I wanted. I'd love it, and I wanted to do it. And, you know, and it was, so she was, you know, she was just getting all her degrees then with working with Pete, her uncle. And I'd worked with Pete on a few projects as well, and Perry. And so it was fun when we just said, you know what, let's do nobody's got a women design company, and I absolutely love to design. So I'm excited about that because she's really come a long way, and I've learned so much since then. You know, I've done a whole course at University of Georgia on grass. So I'm really excited to have a new venture.
Boy, you are amazing. Always ahead of your time, Jan Stevenson. Really. Just thank you so much for spending this much time with us this morning, and continued success. And I look forward to seeing you up in Connecticut at the U.S. Senior Women's Open this week.
Yeah, me too, Anne. It was nice to talk to you again.
Thanks so much. All right, we have to close out the show. Unfortunately, having so much fun. But my thanks to Jan Stevenson, to Pat Norton, to Ed Arzuman in the studio. Talking Golf with Anne Liguori is brought to you by iBeCool Luxury Athleisure Apparel for women and men, performance-driven, stylish, and ultra-soft for all your on- and off-course activities. Visit iBKUL.com. olympicgolf.com to learn more. Both Bryson DeChambeau and John Rahm are out of Olympic competition after testing positive for COVID-19 during the final testing protocol before departing for Tokyo. That's the latest news. And stay tuned for Rick Wolf and the Sports Edge. I'll be talking with you next Sunday morning right here on Talking Golf with Ann LaGorrie.